So if you are what you eat, better think carefully about what's on the menu. And first and foremost, make sure you've got a seat at the table. These are a few of the lessons from our next guest. She visits Josephine County this week to talk about food policy and how our relationship to food production, preparation, and consumption could help create a more empowered citizenry. She's a poet and essayist and the director of civic engagement at Portland State University's National Policy Consensus Center. She also serves as executive director of the national nonprofit Kitchen Table Democracy. Wendy Willis, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me, Emily.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. So tell us a little bit about Kitchen Table Democracy. How does that fit into the National Policy Consensus Center?
So Kitchen Table Democracy is an organization actually that was founded 15 years ago by elected officials around the country to try to create, to experiment with better public decision-making models. And it actually doesn't have anything to do with food directly, but the idea is that the metaphor of kitchen table democracy for us is that we're good at solving problems at the kitchen table, and we're good at talking things through and having fellowship and conviviality, and so that the public sphere could certainly use more of those things. And so that's where Kitchen Table Democracy, the name Kitchen Table Democracy, came from the nonprofit was one of the founding organizations that founded the National Policy Consensus Center here at Portland State, so that there's a nonprofit arm and a university arm as well.
Right. That's interesting. You mentioned the draw of the kitchen. I know in my house, even if it's the tiniest and sometimes dirtiest room, it seems to be where everybody wants to be.
Yes.
And in the case of Kitchen Table Democracy, that's a metaphor for getting people into a space to talk to one another. But you're giving a talk this Friday at the Illinois Valley branch of the Josephine Community Libraries in Cave Junction. And that is literally about food and citizenship, correct?
That's right. Right.
So what does it mean to you to connect to your food beyond the obvious of chewing, swallowing, and digesting it and all the rest?
Right, right. And I guess I will, you know, I'll start by saying when I've done these conversations in many libraries and community centers and public spaces around the state on behalf of Working Humanities, and it's, you know, there are oftentimes people in the room that have much more expertise about food itself. You know, they're either growers or they're food scientists, they're food activists, and I'm really a layperson. I'm a home cook, I'm a gardener, but I find it a place that the possibilities keep unfolding, right? So I think one of the things I think about when I think about public life is that oftentimes we talk about it in terms of participation being a burden, and one of the things that food brings to us is pleasure. And so is that sort of entry, is the entryway of thinking about food or gathering with food a way to take some of the to take some of the work out of being, you know, good neighbors and good citizens and good society builders. And so that's sort of my starting place. And I think that, you know, there are many other entry points where we can use food as a mechanism to think about ourselves as active participants in civic life.
And going back to my question, for you, when you feel like a connection to a particular food product, is that because of how it was produced or how you acquired it? Or what to you are sort of the benchmarks for taking the pleasure of food and translating it into an experience with other humans or an experience where you exchange ideas?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there are multiple ways, but one of the ways that I think of is say, you know, my kids went to a school it's a public school, but it had they were older now, but when they were, you know, in grade school still, it had a kitchen garden, and the kids planted and harvested and used it in the kitchen and learned how to use all these things. And then, so they started understanding, so, okay, here's how carrots are grown and how long it takes and how much water, et cetera. And so then you go to the grocery store and you notice, okay, here are carrots here. Why are they wilty? Or why are they not as crisp as the ones that we grew in the garden? And then you start to think about, okay, well, where did it come from? And how far did it travel? And how much fossil fuels did it take to get there? And what are the policies that are, you know, leading to transporting of food? So if it were if for myself, I can't. It's hard for me to conceive of what my relationship to the farm bill is. But if I can say, I'm making soup. Here are the ingredients. Where did those ingredients come from, and what are the implications of that? It's, for me, a much more human scale than starting at the macro. And I think that any stop along the way, we can be more conscious and more participatory without feeling like, okay, I need to lobby my member of Congress and understand the ins and outs of food subsidies.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Wendy Willis. She's executive director of Kitchen Table Democracy. It doesn't actually have a lot to do with kitchens in a literal sense, but part of a nonprofit structure to better integrate citizen voices from across the state into policy decision making. Wendy's giving a talk in Josephine County this Friday at the library in Cave Junction at 5 o'clock. That's Friday, May 13th, to continue this conversation. Or you can join us now, 800-838-3760, or email jx@jeffnet.org with your thoughts about how do you perceive your food, or when did you ever have an aha moment with food that made you see the world or engage with the world differently? Wendy, you were just talking about knowing where ingredients came from. It can help you understand a more macro level of food policy and how agriculture is regulated and where food comes from. For me, I sometimes have those moments where I feel a bit more educated, a little bit less ignorant, perhaps, about food systems. But then when I go to the grocery store, I just freeze up because literally every product, I could overthink it. And then I just get hangry and have to buy something and eat it as soon as possible. So how do you take these small epiphanies or learning about where your food comes from and translate them into what would actually be considered civic engagement?
Yeah, I think that's the navigation that we all have to make, right? Where we start to feel like every consumer choice is a vote, which in some sense it is, but then it can either become immobilized or cynical, and that's not the goal. And I think it's not just food, right? It's choices about what we drive and what we wear and where we send our kids to school and all the day-to-day choices that we uh-huh. make. And what I'm hopeful for is that as we think about these things, we can, you know, say to ourselves, okay, you know, I'm really busy. I only have so much time to think about these things, but today I'm going to make this 1, 2, 3 choices that feel like I'm participating in a way that makes me feel good about where I am in the culture. And I know that other people have a much more discipline than I do, but that's about what I can do right now. And I think that's probably true of all of us, right? As you say, you can become immobilized by all the choices we have and then what the implications of each and every choice are.
And now this topic, it's not your first time taking this topic around as a conversation project. Earlier you mentioned something that stuck out to me, talking about civic engagement and awareness often being seen as a burden versus food being associated with pleasure. So if somehow we can take a little bit of the pleasure we get from food and inject it into our civic lives, that might be a good recipe for success. Can you give me an example of when you've seen the burden lifted through food?
Well, I mean, just one of the things that I think as those of us who work to get the public involved in decision making, I think the thing we absolutely know is if people join together around food before the meeting, during the meeting, even after the meeting, that it takes on a different spirit. The gathering takes on a different spirit. And Portland Public Schools, I have to say here, when they do their committee meetings, their public committee meetings, where they have all these volunteers come in after work, they always start with a meal. And they don't meet during that meal. They say, you know, show up a half hour before we gavel the meeting. And they get together, they have nice food. Oftentimes they're food from different cultures, which is fun, right? So people get to experience cultures, talk, you know, there are, people can talk about their grandparents, their parents, and where these foods came from. And I think it's a very, it would be a very easy thing to cut corners on, but I think it makes a tremendous difference in relationship building and understanding people sort of as individuals rather than as functionaries of some sort.
So food brings us together. On the flip side, when you are part of, say, an Oregon Humanities Conversation Project, you're going to go to Josephine County this week, and maybe everyone there brings a different perspective to the table. Maybe they disagree. What kinds of things do people tend to disagree on when you talk about food and food systems?
I have to say, in this particular conversation, I've done other topics where there's serious disagreement. I would say, you know, people will talk about, I think there's two areas where there's tension, and I wouldn't say it's a disagreement, but there's tension in the arguments, right? And one of those is about the economic viability of, you know, eating locally, eating organically. So the tension of cheap food tends to be unhealthy food, right? I mean, that's a broad statement, but there's a correlation often, and a lot often because it's subsidized, and so folks will have to wrestle with the idea that some of the values around the slow food movement and the organic food movement lead to more expensive food, and probably because we're paying the true cost of production. And that there are many people in this country and in our own communities that that it's hard enough to put any food on the table, let alone food that you know, where we're paying the growers appropriately and the workers, et cetera. So I think that tension around economic security and food security versus a sort of you know, privileged food movement definitely comes out. And that question is, it's a good space for people to have real conversations. And I wouldn't say anyone argues with each other over it, but they definitely recognize it and talk it over. And so I think that's one area. The other place where I'd say there's a real policy conversation that often happens is around genetic modification of foods and whether or not there are human health consequences and whether there are environmental consequences and whether that gets down way into the sort of the weeds, but oftentimes folks will have that conversation.
Yeah, and perhaps literally in the weeds, GMOs banned, of course, here in Jackson County, one of several counties that hear this program. Going back to your point there about economic security versus a sort of privileged view of food, like, well, it's nice to buy organic, but it's nice work if you can get it, kind of. Where do those tensions go when people are sitting at the same table? What kind of ideas end up in the air that would maybe lead towards a middle ground, or have you seen people actually change their perspective?
Well, I think there's all kinds of really great stories, right, of food banks and churches and other types of, you know, sort of local food pantries that are using growing as part of their food sourcing. And that is, first of all, a healthful alternative, fresh healthful alternative. But in addition to that, that the growing process oftentimes has these great associated benefits of people working together across economic and racial and other lines. And so that's a very cool and interesting place where people start to talk about possibility in a way that's sort of exciting. They're like, oh, you know, there's a big patch of grass at the community center or wherever. Could we use, not just have a community garden in the sense that people create a community garden for their own family, but create a garden that, you know, that benefits folks that are facing food insecurity.
We're talking with Wendy Willis. She's executive director of Kitchen Table Democracy, actually not about food, but about bringing people together to discuss public policy. And in this case, the policy of food is part of a talk she's given on Friday in Cave Junction. You can join us now at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan, and we want to hear about how your community deals with food, growing your own, and trying to create security, even though perhaps organic options are more expensive. Whatever your story is, if it's food-related, we want to hear it now. Let's go to a call from John in Grants Pass. John, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Hi.
Thank you. When I was teaching high school, we had Russian kids as exchange students after Russia collapsed. And I'll tell you this, they were just absolutely stunned by the quality, not just the amount of food we have, but the quality, the choices, like you say, genetically organic stuff like that. You know, you can't force people to eat that. But they were just stunned. I'll give you an example. We took them to Fred Meyer, and they thought there was going to be, when they saw all the food in the store, they thought there was going to be a riot. You better call the police. Because in Russia, she said, one of the girls said, we eat meat and potatoes. No, not even meat. We just eat potatoes. They don't even have fresh fruit or vegetables. Their supply system is horrible. Our supply system, really, if you think about it, is fantastic. There's never a shortage of anything. So just a comment. I mean, once again, we should eat well, but you can't outlaw pizza or hot dogs or potato chips. You know, it's in the end, it is a personal choice. So anyway, that's kind of my comment. I think we have a fantastic system.
Thank you for that, John. And when those Russians came, was that in the Soviet? Oh, looks like we lost John. I'm curious if that was a story from the 80s or from present day. Wendy, he brings up an interesting point in terms of abundance. Do you get the sense that people appreciate how abundant food is for so many Americans?
I think, yeah, I mean, I definitely think, and especially people who have either lived overseas or had other had experiences like the one that John described where people visit, just the number of choices. I will say that that level of abundance is not uniform in the United States. And I think we've all, maybe many of us have heard of the concept of food deserts, which happens, you know, in urban settings and rural settings around the country where, you know, even if it's in an area of the country where there's a lot of growing potential, the food is, you know, being exported or being transported to other parts of the country, and people don't have close access to fresh foods, really, literally at all. So people are supplying their family food from the 7-Eleven or the gas station, because if they don't have a car or public transportation isn't reliable, that the food supply is pretty bleak. And so I completely agree with John that we have so many choices in many instances, that's not a uniform condition for Americans.
I can think of many places within our listening area where the nearest grocery store might be 30 or 40 miles away from wherever someone could hear this broadcast. If you're in that position, give us a call, 800-838-3760, or email jx@jeffnet.org. We want to hear about how you keep your food supply reliable and also civically engaged, thoughtful, even if you live in a very rural area and maybe can't just pop down to the store and buy whatever you want. Wendy, another thing that John's comments raised for me was this issue of waste. And does that come up when you talk to people, you know, about kind of what eats them about food? Do we waste more food, and are there policies to address that or try to curb it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And food, it does come up oftentimes in terms of, you know, large-scale waste. Of course, people talk, you know, have concerns about that. And when we have food insecurity and hunger, how do you live with the level of waste that we have, both in restaurants and grocery stores, right? But the other thing that I think is interesting is people talk about it in terms of their own relationship to food, that the more intimate and attentive they are to their own food, the less likely they are to overbuy or let things spoil or go to waste, and so that it has a kind of internal quality to it. I know in my own family, when the kids were littler, the expression was "don't disrespect the farmer." So the idea was just buy, you know, as many grapefruits as you need, because think about all the hard work and love and sweat that went into getting this grapefruit to you. And if we let it go to waste, it's not only is it revealing that we have too much, but it also is disrespectful of all the people who brought it to us. And so I really hear that story, that the more attentive people are to their own meals, even if they're super simple, that the less likely there is to be food waste in their own home.
And is that attention just a product of intention? I'm thinking about people, this happens to me a lot, where I just get really busy,
yeah,
or I don't have the money to buy organic, and I'm not exactly taking pleasure in the idea that I'm eating this green that I, you know was on a truck for the last 2,000 miles. Are there other ways to cultivate that joy in food that we really want to transfer into our civic lives? If you are really busy, stressed out, you have three kids, or you don't have the money to buy nicer, more local food.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be fancy. I really don't.
Uh-huh.
I don't think the food does. I mean, think about how great it is to be able to eat a banana, right?
Mm-hmm. Thinking about it right now.
Mm-hmm. And just what it tastes like. And even if you've got everybody, like this morning, I was rushing everybody to get out the door to school so I could get here, right, and talk to you. You know, it was not our finest hour, but just, you know, the moment when you're peeling the orange in your hand, even if the next moment you're rushing to the car, connecting to that food, and what an amazing thing it is. I mean, there's no banana trees for, you know, hundreds of miles from my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I get to have an orange or a banana at lunchtime is an amazing thing and a delicious thing. And it's really only, you know, it's not to say that everyone can afford a banana, but that it's relatively affordable compared to what you might think it would be, right?
Considering how far away it's grown,
yeah.
and that, yeah, a whole, I mean, we have just scratched the surface here with Wendy Willis, Executive Director of Kitchen Table Democracy. It's a nonprofit organization housed in Portland State University aimed at getting people to care about public policy and talk about it. That's just what will be going on Friday evening at the Illinois Valley branch of the Josephine Community Libraries. Wendy Willis will be leading a conversation there from 5 to 6:30 p.m. It's called We Are What We Eat. Wendy, thank you for being a guest of The Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
You're welcome.